Welcome to Season 2 of Assessment in Focus, the podcast from Inspira, where we invite our guests to share their insights on assessment, transformation, innovation, and enhancement. My guest on this episode is Matt Carnock from the University of Leeds. Matt and I first met at a conference, and I'm going to say right at the start of this episode, it's worth following Matt on LinkedIn because his summaries of what he sees and hears at conferences are superb. The first time I read one was one of my own, and I really saw that I got the message across. So as a starting point, go follow Matt, but after you've listened to the episode. Let me tell you a little bit more about him before we start. Matt has 20 years of experience in online and digital education. He specializes in the design and development of fully online programs and short courses, with a particular interest in the intersection of higher education and professional learning. As a senior leader at the University of Leeds, he coordinates activity across professional services and drives forward the growth and quality of online education. He's led award-winning teams, is a trustee of the Association for Learning Technology, and is a champion for bringing together online and subject discipline pedagogies. Matt brings a passion for collaboration, learning design, and creating accessible online courses that enable learners to succeed and continue their learning journeys. And Matt, firstly from me, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thanks very much for the invitation, and very much appreciating your comments on my reflections on various conference activities, and particularly your session as well. It was a fun session.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. They're really good. So I'm going to say, please go look at them. They're visual. Some of them are videos. I'm going to put a link to my one underneath the podcast in the title so that people can find them and see more of them. But Matt, I invited you on to ask you some questions, and I'll get on with those. My first question is, if assessment shapes what society values in education, what might today's assessment practices be signaling, intentionally or not?
This is a really interesting question, because we all have experience of education from schooling and then upwards. And I think the attitudes towards assessment start even before primary school sometimes, but there's an expectation that you will be assessed on your learning, and that assessment is going to stay with you for the rest of your life. And I can always remember the pressure that's put on students, particularly at GCSE and A level. It's sort of your assessment's the next gateway into your life or into another stage of education. So there's this tying up of assessment with recognition, and that recognition with opening doors to the next level. So assessment is already having this momentum behind it, being a high pressure situation. And it's all about individuality. It's about recognizing that as an individual, that person as an individual. And it's completely different in the real world in terms of the world of work, where you're assessed really on the success of you in your role, your success on your outputs, your success being a human being. It can't be quantified sometimes. You don't get a piece of paper about it all the time. And I think there's this mix of sort of formal recognition you get through assessment. And something that I was speaking to Doug Belshaw at a particular event about social recognition and which is valued more in different circumstances. This idea of social recognition where, you know, me saying great work ish, you know, you've got the Matt Carnock thumbs up in terms of what you're doing in a particular session, may be incredibly meaningful and valuable to you at that point in time, more so than if I'd given you a certificate that says, you know, you've done an excellent session. It's the social element that recognition comes into play quite a lot. But in formal education, that is a societal recognition in the sense that it's more than a rubber stamp. It's a set of principles and values that goes behind a very structured approach to assessing an individual against particular criteria. And sometimes that works. You need it for certain professions. You need it if you're going to be an electrician, because I want to know that you know what you're doing when you're rewiring my house. You need it when you're a doctor, because I want to know that, you know, I'm going to be in the best care possible and you're not going to have to look everything up every 5 minutes, you know, for whatever situation. There are certain sort of standards that we expect in particular professions. But is that true of everything that everyone does? And is that true of who we need to be as a a group of human beings, you know. So I think there's this really interesting tension between formal education and what that sets, opportunities for social recognition and how that differs from that formality as well. But my view is definitely of the view that assessment should be about learning. So rather than assessment to get your piece of paper, assessment processes should be about learning. And Dylan William and Paul Black established the assessment for learning approach, you know, decades ago. Formative assessment, informal assessment, peer assessment, other techniques that enable students to take stock of where they are and work out where they need to go next. And for educators, where are your students now? And using data from that assessment process to guide them towards the next step. And we often forget that that is actually the most valuable part of assessment. It's not about the grade or the rubber stamp. It's about how do you then propel yourself to the next stage. And I think that assessment for learning really needs to come through more strongly from a societal point of view as well.
We're seeing more assessment for learning, but to take your journey as you put it, that next step is seen as the summative that comes afterwards, or one of the summatives that comes afterwards. How are we going to decouple either that relationship so that assessment for learning stands by itself and has a greater meaning, and as a rolled up question, so two in one, which is one what one should never do as a barrister, and despite being one and teaching them, I'm going to do it. How do we get closer to what you're espousing here, which is that assessment should have a different purpose to the letter, number, grade, whatever comes at the end, that's for a wider world almost rather than the individual? So sorry, two questions in one, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, that last point there, you know, the grade is for the wider world in many sense, because that's what you take to your employer, that's what you take to another institution to say, look, I've got my certification here. And I'm not sure how we as a society change this view of or sort of give more value to the learning process. And Professor Naomi Winston said at the RAI conference that was recently this year, it makes little sense to value a polished piece of work. And that's about process over product. So can we look at a more realistic view that as we are learning through educational programs, as we are reflecting on our own learning, how do we articulate that in a way that we can also still get that certification at the end? So yes, that certification end has to be there for certain knowledge bases anyway. We talk about applied learning, we talk about evaluating and critical thinking. Can we add more about that self-reflective aspect into those formal assessments? And it's something we actually do in the design of our online learning programs at the University of Leeds, is in every module, we have almost like a template of behavior that we're expecting, learning behavior that we're expecting in every unit. And at the end of every unit is a consolidation activity. And it's actually encouraging that reflective piece as part of the learning process. In some cases, you know, you would end up with assessments that require that reflective process. I remember when I was doing my master's with the OU, you always had to include it, categorize like 10, 20% of your final module mark, something that you've taken from your discussions with other students, and you've learned and you've reflected on your own practice, and that forms part of your assessment as well. So there's always going to be a need to have a certificate, and there's actually in some cases a very good reason for that. But can we do more about the process of learning and process of assessment? And I think that is something that's on us as educators to think about, but also to encourage our students to think about that as well, so that they don't see this assessment as so, it's such a risky activity sometimes, assessment. Mm. And they don't see it as the pain point of learning, but actually the culmination of their learning instead.
Yeah, I like that. The idea that it is a culmination, it's not the pain or the cost of doing the learning itself. As we talk about change that's taking place, we can't escape the one that is, even if it's not the thing itself, certainly the debate is having the widest impact on education and higher education, that is AI. So to ask you a very broad question, will AI transform or undermine educational assessment. And I very much, I know in advance that your answer is more nuanced than that. But let's start with the broad to give you a space to go wherever you want.
We couldn't have this discussion without talking about AI. It's impossible, you know. And I don't think anyone has actually got the right answer to this, because there isn't one right answer to this as well. There's always an it depends part to it. But anyway, we can't design our assessments for students not to use AI. And I'm even going to extend that as far as the closed book written examination, because students will be or could be using AI to prepare for that examination. And those types of examinations will require students to bring together a whole range of different learning over a longer period of time, perhaps, than just a single module, in the best types of those assessments, you know, being quite holistic, the synoptic type assessments. And AI can actually be a very valuable tool to help students structure their thoughts, structure their learning. So it is being used, even if it's not actually being used in the exam hall. And so for us to think that AI cannot, you know, we can try and sort of protect our assessments from AI, isn't the world that we live in anymore. We have, at the University of Leeds, we've had this sort of red, amber, green approach to the use of assessment, particularly in sort of trying to explain where AI can be used as part of closed and open assessments in particular. And we see the shift now from everything being red to acknowledging that most situations probably amber, where there's an opportunity to use AI in specific cases. So, for example, to prepare your notes or to consolidate, or even to help structure the writing up. There was a really interesting quote from a student panel recently where they're saying, well, these amber guidelines, they're so vague. There's still a lot of latitude there to feel like you're doing the wrong thing. And again, going back to the idea of pain point of assessment, if we're introducing uncertainty in our guidance, then that just exacerbates that experience of the assessment in a negative way even further. So either, you know, if there are some parameters that we really want to be clear about, then be very clear. Otherwise, let go of it and see what happens. And maybe this is where we can actually start experimenting in a lower risk environment. So not at the summative stage, but at the formative stage. What actually happens when you let students use AI in the formative sense? We were looking at a particular assessment on, I think it was a poster design, and we engaged some students to actually sort of do a dummy run of this assessment to see if we could run this with a fully open AI awareness or whatever. But the key point about all this is that students value learning. At the ALT conference, the Association for Learning Technology conference, students were asked about their use of AI in assessment. And there was a student from the first year undergraduate, second year undergraduate, third year undergraduate. First and second year were saying, yeah, we're using it. We're not going to disclose entirely how much we're using it, but we're using it. And the third year student said, I'm not learning. They realized that they weren't learning by putting their thought, they weren't learning by outsourcing their thought patterns to the AI. And they were actually realizing now, in order to get the most out of the degree, where they've invested heavily in their time, heavily in their money, that they actually wanted to put the work in and do the work and their assessment themselves rather than outsourcing it. And it's that kind of realization that students will come to when they go through these processes. So will it transform or will it undermine educational assessment? It's there. I don't think it's a polar sort of discussion. I think there are some opportunities, though. And another example that was shared at the Hepburn conference last week on was a student panel. And they were describing how in their institution, they were looking at using AI for marking. And the initial reaction from the students was, well, we've put loads of time and invested our energy into these assessments. Why are you marking them using AI? We want the human aspect to this. And it was clarified. And the way that it was explained was that AI would go through with the rubric and match up where the rubric was met in the assessment. But there was the academic team there to add the nuance and to then take that initial marked assessment and frame it for that particular student. And it's that human connection that we mustn't let go of in education, wherever it is in the journey. And I think this is a really clever use of AI to be objective where we need to be objective around the rubric and add that subjectivity when we're trying to explain the nuance of that assessment back to the student and then nuance that feedback back to the student. The other option, obviously, is with the administrative support. Assessments are incredibly administratively intensive, and it's often a hidden part of the assessment journey. And there is potential there for AI maybe to support some of these processes and maybe give more flexible engagement in courses because of the way that, you know, assessment schedules work in a university or an institution. So maybe AI actually has a role to play behind the scenes as well as actually with what students are doing with their learning.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it is that way of looking at the nuance of what a machine can do, what a human can do. I think despite the sometimes the polar opposites that one sees online, the majority of people appear to be in the middle of, I want the human doing the human bit. I think we're perhaps debating what the human bit is. But I actually want to ask you a follow-up based on something that you said earlier, which is the red, amber, green system was very, very popular, probably, or started being popular a couple of years ago. My concern with anything that has a middle point is that that's where people rush to. The University of Sydney approach, which is now being taken on by many others, of secure and open, so very much saying to both educator and student, you have to nail your colours to the mast on this. There's no ambiguity. Is that perhaps the answer, to remove that student ambiguity and say either you can or you can't? There's no maybe to it.
I don't think there's a clear cut right or wrong to that. Sometimes the middle ground is incredibly useful where we do want to enable students to use AI. Maybe there's a part of that assessment that is very authentic to the workplace and we see AI being used in the workplace, but there's other parts to it that we really want the student to be independent and do their own analysis or do their own thinking. So amber as a middle ground may have some parameters like that, but it doesn't allow for a student to use AI without declaring it or without being very specific in how it's being used in that output. And there is a potential tension there between AI as part of the process and AI as part of the output as well. So the red, amber, green, very useful in some situations. Sometimes you need that very clear cut, absolutely no use of AI when we really want to ensure that individual's competent in whatever we're assessing. But I think there is a context always around assessment that makes it very difficult to rule out one particular approach or another.
I think that's fair. I think it's making sure that amber can exist as long as it's not ambiguous.
Yeah.
Different point now, away from AI, I'm not prejudging your answer, but how can assessment be designed to genuinely reflect and respect diverse cultural perspectives on learning and knowledge, rather than assuming that there's just an academic norm? And I'm particularly interested in your answer, Matt, because of the nature of the sorts of programs that you're involved with.
Yeah. This is a wonderful question. I'm going to give you a couple of different perspectives as well. So the first perspective I've got here is on sort of discipline approaches versus interdisciplinary approaches to assessment. Some disciplines will have a well-trodden path in terms of how they assess their students. But actually, I'm really interested in this intersection between academic and professional learning. And we see in the professional learning in particular a growing need for more interdisciplinary thinking and interdisciplinary practices. And academic silos are breaking down, which is a really positive thing to see. So the degree programs we have in our online master's programs at the University of Leeds, every single one of them in one shape or another is actually an interdisciplinary program. It may be a single module. It may be that the whole program has a 50-50 split between different faculties contributing their different perspectives. But what can bring them together, though, is having that awareness of that common thread throughout the whole program, and giving students that scaffold to try different forms of assessment. So in our design of our programs, we're always thinking about the mapping of assessments over those modules. And then within those modules, how do we scaffold the learning needed in the skills and the approaches to complete those assessments successfully? So it's not assuming that every student can come to these programs with everything they need to know about being successful. And particularly for some of our programs where we have performance-based admission approaches, where someone can come to the program with maybe not a degree in that specialist area, but can prove that they can do the program through completing initial modules. That's where we really need to put in our effort in terms of supporting and structuring their completion of those assessments. And obviously, as they go further in the program, they build more confidence, they're a bit more used to the different types. But I always remember that tension between when you first come into a degree and you see you've been asked to write a report for the first time, and how different that is from your previous experience writing essays. And that can just really throw students. So being able to respond to a broad, diverse range of learners, particularly those returning back to education later in life, where maybe the last time they wrote an essay was 25 years ago, we've really got to be supporting that journey. And I don't see that as being separate skill support either. It has to be embedded as part of the learning design of the program of study. Another case is on our Disability Studies Rights and Inclusion program, our award-winning program, where we were really looking at inclusive practice throughout the whole program. And the academic team had a very clear vision about how they wanted to make this program available and inclusive to as many people as possible. And throughout, they have the opportunity to submit their assessments either in a written form or a presentation form. And that's because we know that students will have different needs for a disability reason or impairment reason. And this still enables them to show that they can meet the outcomes of the course. And I think that's such an important perspective for us all to take, not to be wedded to one particular type of assessment, but to think about how creatively we can enable students to demonstrate that they can achieve the outcomes of courses.
You know that that's a topic very dear to me, Matt. I really want to see a greater diversity in the way that we assess people from a personal perspective, but also from a we are different perspective. I know that there's then potentially the mismatch if we use the same assessment instruments again and again, that we may build up that skill and potentially to a point where there's diminishing returns while ignoring others. My next question may well, for some people, relates to that, but you may have a different point you're going to raise, which is, What's the real barrier to assessment change right now? Policy, institutional systems, the habits of educators? Where's that barrier in your mind?
We're at an interesting crossroads in higher education. We have some very well-established approaches to formal education, and we also have some emerging approaches, more flexible routes to learning. Some of those are championed at policy level, at a national policy level. Some of those are more local approaches. And I think every institution is trying to navigate their policy obligations with these creative approaches. So traditionally, QA processes in universities where you propose your program, propose your module, you define exactly what that assessment is going to be. They're starting to shift now in terms of, well, how can we actually still maintain the quality, still know what students are going to be expected to do whilst giving more flexibility in the module to make changes. And at this point, I think we're at the point where you've still got the assessment set at the very beginning of the module, but once you've gone around the evaluation cycle, you've got that feedback, you've learned from how students have responded to the assessment, you've learned as an academic in terms of how you've been able to mark that assessment in the way and how well that assessment actually enables students to evidence their learning. Once you've gone around that evaluation cycle, can you quickly change that assessment for the next time? Or do you have to go around the entire QA process before you can do that, and therefore update and notify students and change your catalog data? I think we're seeing a shift now to be a bit more responsive to what our students need without going through the full administrative processes. It would be interesting to see how far we can stretch that in terms of, you've got students on module right now, and you're under, as an educator, you're learning about what their interests are, what their needs are. You've got a particular cohort that really wants to focus on a particular area, but the assessment's on something they don't care about, or it's not going to be relevant to their professional learning. How can you actually adjust that assessment in module while it's running, and yet still enable them to demonstrate the outcomes? The outcomes stay fixed. It's the assessment that could flex. And I think that's a really interesting challenge that I don't think we're quite there yet with grappling. There are some really interesting and novel approaches. There's the SOL scheme that we've got here at Leeds, where students can use open access courses, and then they use those to scaffold their independent study. And there's an assessment, a broader assessment that they can use in that way. So the assessment itself is quite flexible, but that's not standardized across a whole program. That's like one module or one particular way of doing it, but it's certainly not an institutional approach. So it's it gives that flexibility, but only in a particular modular way. The other aspect I'm really interested in is actually the flexibility of our assessment submission processes, and there's that tension between administrative processes that have a set calendar and a set schedule and the, you know, checks and balances we have to do, versus how do we create a more flexible way for students to be assessed over a longer period of time. Glasgow has a flexible submission window for some as part of their policies, that they enable academics to choose this as a method, for example, for coursework, where they offer a whole week. You can submit within this week. And it just gives students a bit more ownership over their time. It probably also acknowledges that students are probably taking multiple modules at the same time.
Yes.
And one of the first things I did when I was working with a department was, can we map out, please, our first year undergraduate assessments? And we spotted that on these first year undergraduate assessments, the first term, they had four essays coming in all at the same time. Like, okay, this is, can we think about how we can scaffold this, change the assessment format, stretch, you know, some of the deadlines, shuffle things around a bit. And it's that kind of thinking that I really would like to see happening at sort of institutional level as well. And it's just a fascinating area to be more flexible and think about that more holistic student journey.
Flexible assessment, programmatic assessment, they are both things that were difficult in a world of technology and process 10, 20, 30 years ago. So I'm completely with you, because we now have the operational capability to do them. And you're right, there's emerging pockets of great practice, but across the sector, there is more that we can be doing here. And it's that level of responsiveness to student need and student interest. I've spoken to module leaders and lecturers who have managed to build that in within the confines of their own institution's policies to say, yeah, that's what I want to do. And actually, I'm in the room gauging the interest. And we know, you know, more engaged with the topic, therefore, if the assessment's matching, more engaged with the assessment, better outcomes, better learning. So yeah, I'm totally there with it. Now, for my final question, I would say that people could go back and use lots of things that you've said. So that I'm not restricting them to just taking the one that you've got. But I do like to ask people this, a takeaway from listening to this podcast. What is one practical change an individual academic could make next year that would genuinely improve the student's experience of assessment, feedback, or both?
Take your own module. From a student point of view, okay, we often, when we're creating content, creating courses, creating activities, we are always thinking about how the students are engaging with these activities and the journey they're going to take. But when you're in the thick of it, sometimes you just need to take a step back and just think, right, okay, am I being clear about what my expectations of the students are for assessment? Is my assessment brief without ambiguity? Where does it introduce uncertainty, pain points, the ambiguity that we need to support the students through? As far as possible, you don't want to be in the position where you're then updating students with changes, you know, in the middle of a module. But in order to take that perspective, what have you learned from the last time you taught this course or a course similar to it? I go back to the assessment for learning point earlier, where you can design a multiple choice quiz. And instead of putting your one correct answer and three distractors in there, those three distractors could actually tell you something about how your students are learning. If you know what the common misconceptions are, if you know that there are terms that are easily confused, or if you know that students maybe are applying their knowledge in a way that maybe not might need a bit more exploration, you can actually use those distractor questions to give you data to then respond to. And that might be responding to them immediately the next session, say, okay, I can see a lot of you here. You know, don't use formative assessment in a way that's just throwaway or a sense check for the students. Use it as an educator as well. And then how do you then feed that in through into the summative assessment? And then from your summative assessment, how's that going to change how you do your next run of the module? And it's always thinking from that student point of view, okay, what's gone on here? How have they understood this? How have they learned? Most educators, good educators, are already doing this. But if you're not, then it is worth just taking a step back and putting yourself in your students' shoes.
I think that's excellent advice. I'm going to add something in terms of multiple choice questions. I've found in the past asking people how confident they are in their answer, why they picked that one, which one they would have picked otherwise. Fewer questions, more of that. You can get some really rich data. I'm a proponent of multiple choice questions in some scenarios because they make people pick an answer. You can't ambiguously try and shotgun everything that you might want to say. But that's a really great piece of advice, Matt, and I hope people listening take heed of it if they're not already doing it. And indeed, everything that you've said, this has genuinely been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. And I want to thank our listeners too. If you found this useful, please like, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. If you've got time for a review, that's always welcome. And that is all for this episode. Assessment in Focus is brought to you by Inspira, providing flexible assessment with integrity. I've been Ishan Kolhatkar, and I will see you next time. Thank you very much again.